Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for this hour of debate, dialogue, healthcare, and science in the news, and answers to your questions and emails. I'll be giving out the numbers in a few minutes, but before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program are those of the speakers, not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It's not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. Well, last week I brought you an all-email show while I was away at the Institute for Functional Medicine annual symposium. And this symposium was all about the omics revolution. And this is genomics, proteomics, viromics. The ohms just keep coming. We've got viromics. It's just amazing. And so I'll be bringing you some of the highlights of that conference today and in the next few weeks. A couple of really important things that came out of this conference, which really spent a long time talking about genetics, what we know, what we don't know, and more important than that, what is actually actionable. Well, it's one thing to know whether that you have a DNA snip or a single nucleotide polymorphism that increases your risk of a disease, let's say from the 1.0 odd that is the norm for the population at large, the average odds. Let's say it takes you to 1.07. Okay, a 7% increase. Do you care? And especially if you can't do anything about it because we don't know how to change it. Well, yeah, those are your odds and that's that. So what we want when we look at our genomics is we want to look at those things that we can change, where there is an important risk. And by the way, most epidemiologists would say that a risk that is double, in other words, a 2.0 odds ratio, are the ones that you want to focus on. And a lot of this stuff that comes out of our current genomics is less than that. And we'll come back to that in subsequent shows, talking about genome-wide association studies and what they tell us and what they don't. Although currently the medical literature is full of them, they're a very sexy topic. When it gets down to the level of the nuts and bolts clinical care, really doesn't necessarily tell you much. But there are a few genes that we all have heard of, BRCA1 and BRCA2, the breast cancer risk genes, I think are one that is substantially well known due to, well, it's become famous in the wake of Angelina Jolie's decision to remove both of her breasts preventatively. And you can make the argument whether that was a good choice or a bad choice, but what comes out of this genomics is, well, some very interesting both ethical and personal dilemmas. But I wanted to take a moment and drill down a little bit further on BRCA1 and 2, because what I learned at the conference was subtle, but I think I can take you through it, and it's really important. You hear that 85% risk of breast cancer, lifetime risk of breast cancer by the age of 70, quoted all the time. But that comes from studies in which they went out looking for female relatives of people who had had breast cancer and tested them for BRCA1 and 2. So in other words, you were looking in the group that had increased risk, and that's what they found, an 85% risk, up to 85%, I should say, because some studies found a 60% risk and so on. But if you just go out and look in the population, not selecting for a family history of breast cancer, the risk drops to 45%. The odds ratio is substantially lower, and that's because you were selecting the population that you were looking in before. So really, a woman who gets her DNA done and finds that she has BRCA1 and BRCA2, or BRCA2, but has not got any family history of breast cancer, and this is presuming that she is not adopted, so she has access to her family history, has a much lower risk, and you really have to be sure that you consider that. Another extremely important thing about breast cancer is it's become the standard of care for estrogen receptor positive tumors to use hormone therapy. In other words, therapies that deprive the breast cancer of hormones. And there's two main ways to do that. You either block the estrogen receptor with tamoxifen, or you prevent the formation of estrogen with a drug like Femara. Now, the nice thing about tamoxifen is that you don't lose bone. And so it's been thought that because Femara can cause substantial osteoporosis in the 5 to 10 years that a woman might use it, in younger women, maybe we should be using tamoxifen first. Well, it turns out that all women taking tamoxifen need to be tested for their 2D6 genotype. Those of you who are regular listeners have heard me talk about the cytochrome P450 system in the liver. It's also, of course, all over our body. But in the liver, it's important for detoxifying all sorts of compounds, and also, in the case of tamoxifen, for activating the drug. Tamoxifen is given as a prodrug. It is not active. It has to be, well, changed. A hydroxy group has to be added to it by this 2D6 enzyme. And many women, a substantial portion of the population, have a weak version of this enzyme and will not succeed in blocking their estrogen receptors because they won't make enough active drug. Also, there are drugs that interact with tamoxifen by inhibiting this 2D6. In other words, when you're taking these other drugs, you, even if you have a normal wild-type 2D6, it won't work as well. Well, it's a long list. And I, for one, have not heard from my breast cancer patients on tamoxifen that they're being informed about that. So I'm going to inform you. Many of the antidepressants, fluoxetine, paroxetine, a lot of sertraline, there are drugs like quinidine and amiodarone, which are used for cardiac methadone and cocaine for people who are using metoclopramide, Reglan, ranitidine, which is Zantac. That's all over the over-the-counter market. There are a lot of other drugs as well. And this is important information for women taking tamoxifen. And I am putting out a question to those women in the audience who are listening to this who are on tamoxifen. I want to know, were you informed either by your doctor or at the pharmacy that you had a potential drug interaction and that you needed to avoid letting a doctor prescribe these other agents to you? I'm very interested in whether that information is being given to the public because it's quite well-established information. Our first email comes from Kirk in Virginia. Dear Dr. Dawn, I'm a longtime podcast listener here on the East Coast. I'm a 64-year-old male in what I would describe as fair health. About 5 weeks ago, my thyroid was removed because of a small cancerous tumor that was discovered through ultrasound. Post-surgery biopsy revealed that the cancer has spread to 2 of the nearby 6 lymph nodes, and my surgeon, internist, and endocrinologist all recommend follow-up therapy using radioactive iodine. My research indicates that radiation therapy, depending on the dosage, will temporarily damage or possibly permanently destroy my salivary glands. I'm already prone to dry mouth and lips, and this side effect could severely affect my quality of life. The doctors all say radiation is the only way to go. What are your thoughts of this course of treatment, and are there alternatives? Is watchful waiting even an option? Also, please recommend ways to ameliorate the salivary gland issue, as well as ways to boost my immune system in advance of the treatment. You're a wonderful nationwide health resource. I and all of your faithful NPR listeners, thank you for your service. Well, I thank you, Kirk, and I hope that I will be able to continue bringing you this program for a very, very long time. Back to your issue. First of all, I agree with your doctors. If the cancer is in your lymph nodes, you have to go after it early, and you have to use radioactive iodine. It would, in my opinion, assuming that you wish to live for another 10 to 15 years with a good quality of life, it would be important to do this. The one exception would be if you had an absolutely horrible lifestyle and lived on nothing but junk food and never exercised, you might make the argument that completely turning around your behavior, your diet, exercising for an hour a day, living on kale shakes and controlling your stress might make be enough of a shift in the cellular environment that it could essentially knock out your cancer. But that's a very risky course to take, and I'm not recommending it. Also, if you're a regular listener to this program and haven't turned me off in disgust, then you probably don't have that really horrible lifestyle. And ironically, if you get a cancer when you have very poor health habits, improving your health habits improves your body's ability to fight off the cancer, maybe even pivotally so. What do they say? No good deed goes unpunished? Well, maybe no bad deed goes unrewarded, at least in this context. So forget about washful waitings. Now, naturally, I want you to do those kale shakes and do all of the other things to support you nutritionally. And I have some specific suggestions, because when people have radiation, this is more commonly with beam radiation rather than with radioactive iodine, they will experience fatigue. And ginseng and mushroom extracts are very helpful for that. And what I recommend is a water extract of the fruiting bodies, not the mycelial elements. And the thing about the mushrooms is you're probably better off, when you're fighting cancer, switching from mushroom to mushroom rather than taking a mix for a long period of time. Do shiitake for a couple of weeks. When you went through that bottle, switch to maitake and so on, and run through the various mushrooms. That seems to be a better strategy when you're dealing with cancer. When people get oral mucositis from radiation, glutamine, honey, and vitamin A can be very helpful. And there are references. I can quote the Annals of Surgery, the Journal of Clinical Oncology, the Journal of Laryngology, otolaryngology. These are really, really established natural things that you can do. Mainly, people do very well with radioactive iodine. It does, your thyroid's already been removed, so you will need supplemental thyroid hormone, but the radioactive iodine is targeted cancer therapy, so the doses are substantially lower than most radiation. So I would encourage you, don't be afraid. Go forward with this. And with respect to its effect on your salivary glands, it's possible that you will knock the glands out somewhat temporarily. But unlike beam radiation for head and neck cancer, which is a much bigger dose, those glands are very likely to come back. And so it's something you may have to face, but I think that the risk is very low. One last thing, aloe vera, actually from the plant, the aloe vera juice isn't as good, although that's great for your gut. But if you have an aloe vera plant and you peel off the skin and take that pulp and put it in your mouth, it's very protective and soothing. And if you do have a dry mouth, it's one of the ways that you can help yourself feel a little better is a little aloe vera in a smoothie in the morning. So I hope that's been helpful, and I want to encourage you to go forward. We're going to go to our first caller, and that's Ed in Paso Robles. Hello, Ed. Welcome.
Good morning, Dr. Don.
Good morning.
One comment on something you said, mushrooms.
Yes.
There are some of us, myself included, aren't supposed to eat mushrooms because of an after effect. Yes, particularly to do with the big toe.
Oh, you're referring to gout?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Well, if you've been advised not to eat something, then you probably shouldn't eat it. In general, I associate gout more with excessive alcohol consumption and excessive protein consumption, because gout is due to the crystallization of purine, which comes from proteins. So I was actually unaware of the mushroom connection, and I will research it further. But in any event, if you've told not to eat it, don't eat it. What was your question, though? I know it wasn't about that.
To do with nuts, which is my nickname.
Okay.
That aside, I got to looking at the data on the back of the nut packages, and all of them that have been suggested have saturated fat in them.
All saturated fats are not created equal, it turns out. It's at least,
is that so?
It is, at least from a cardiac and brain standpoint. It turns out that some of the saturated fats are actually good for you, or let's put it this way, not bad for your heart and pretty darn good for your brain. Coconut and avocado are two of the ones that come to mind immediately that have been shown in studies to actually improve healing after head trauma, seem to have benefits as far as dementia is concerned. Turns out that our brain cells can burn fat, and it has a benefit when you're in a situation where the brain cells are a little bit damaged or on the ropes, so to speak, because of the accumulation of broken down bits of protein that the body can't deal with. This is a something we covered in a previous program. I don't know if you caught it, but we won't go into it in detail. Nuts have been shown actually in studies to improve cardiovascular disease and reduce lipids. It's very paradoxical, but we've been overly simplistic in our understanding of fats. That goes back to, well, probably the 1950s, when people were consuming a great deal more high-fat meats, and we were looking at this sudden, what seemed to be a very sudden increase in coronary artery disease. It led to the Framingham study and associations with saturated fat, but it turns out that it's animal saturated fat that's the big culprit, and that the plant saturated fats are not nearly as bad.
I see. Okay. Another question. All sugars bad for you? I remember from my organic chemistry, which I had to take, I didn't do me any good in college.
Well, who knew?
That there are isomers of sugars.
Yes.
And so all sugars are not the same.
That is true. And there are five carbon sugars that, like ribose, that makes up our DNA and our ATP, and we couldn't live without, structurally live or reproduce cellularly without ATP and DNA. So those are pretty important sugars. As far as the six carbon sugars, you know, that's your glucose and your fructose. Those sugars have it's a moderation in all things kind of thing. Now, first of all, if you never ate any sugar at all, zip, zero, you would still get sugar in your system, because carbohydrate, which is in all plants, is broken down from, it's a carbohydrate is basically a long chain of glucose, and you have enzymes that clip that chain, and so you can't avoid having glucose in your body. Your body runs on it, and it will make it from something else. We were not evolved to be exposed to any other sugar than fruit sugar, which is fructose, and maybe honey, and both of those fairly rarely. Most of the year, fruit is not ripe, and there isn't that much sugar in it. And then in the summertime, we get this brief period where there's all this ripe fruit, and that's what our bodies were evolved for. And of course, because it's rare, we have a genetic predisposition, literally hardwired into our brain. We're born with it. Infants are born with a predisposition to drink sugar water. And that's because it's good for us in that it's free energy. It's rapidly available energy, which is rare out there on the savanna or in the rainforest. So it's that we're giving ourselves too much. And now, due to focus groups and the engineered food supply that we all live with, we've become addicted to it. trained into it from earliest infancy. And what do you do? You know, what do the kids want? They want candy. They want their breakfast cereal. They want, you know, their juice box. And so we've created essentially sugar addiction in our entire population. And that addiction in susceptible individuals leads to obesity and diabetes. And let's not even go to the high fructose corn syrup and how, you know, that's basically digested a little bit differently. It's handled a little bit differently physiologically because the essentially the high fructose piece interferes with the metabolism of the glucose piece. And that is something that was a completely unintended consequence. And now people are backing away from the high fructose corn syrup. They're essentially looking to not buy those foods. And because it's a market economy, the manufacturers of these foods, seeing falling sales, are substituting other forms of sugar, a bit more expensive to them, but at least now they can sell their products. But you still don't want to buy those products because it's still sugar and it's still bad for you except in very small amounts.
What about like dried cherries, dried apricots?
Concentrated. Raisins. Well, dried sour cherries don't have that much sugar in them. Apricots have a reasonable, stone fruits in general have a reasonable amount of sugar. And when you dry a fruit, it's kind of the you can't eat just one phenomenon, right? If I were going to eat an apricot, I might eat three apricots. But if I've got a bowl of dried apricots in front of me, I'm probably going to get six or eight down before before I stop. And so I will have consumed a lot more fruit sugar. And a lot of this has to do with volume. It's like a sink, right? If you fill that sink with water, the limit of how fast it can drain is the size of the drain. And our bodies have a certain rate that they can handle sugar. And that rate is subject to change over time. If we get fat, for example, that rate tends to get smaller. So we back up sugar into our bloodstream, and that's called prediabetes. Mm-hmm. Right? So there's a certain amount that's good that's absolutely necessary, but you can make it. You can make sugar out of protein. I don't know if you know that. But that's a problem. Because if you're in the hospital and you're not getting enough sugar water in your veins because you, for whatever reason, they can't supply enough calories to you through those IVs, really. And so you will start burning muscle. And if you're in the hospital for, let's say, 5-6 days in the intensive care unit, your metabolism goes up because you're sick and you're trying to heal and maybe you're fighting an infection. You can burn through 10-15 pounds of protein in a week. And then your muscles are so weak, and that creates the beginning of the end for a lot of people. And so we really need to do more medically as doctors to preserve the muscle mass of our patients when they're critically ill. It hasn't been a priority. I'd love to see it become a priority, but, you know, I'd love to see a lot of changes in medicine. I'm not going to hold my breath on that one.
That's why they insist that you go out of the hospital in a wheelchair.
Well, they insist that because if you fall while you're still on the hospital grounds, that's their fault. And if you fall when you're getting from your car to your house, it's not your fault. It's not their fault. It's
Thank you very much, Dr. Don. You've been very informative.
I'm so glad. Have a wonderful day.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
I'm going to switch to another email. I have several that I really felt important to get through. This one from Richard in Sweden. It's a very long email, and I'll just kind of abstract it. Richard is 33. He's 6'1", 180 pounds, and he suddenly noticed that he's just making less semen. He feels that it's interfering with his sex life, and he's also got a sleeping problem. He sleeps about 4 or 5 hours and then wakes up and can't fall asleep again. And this will go on for several days. He's also noticed the appearance of some little bumps on his testicles. And he's taking an antidepressant and been on vitamin D because his levels were low. His levels were very low, 24.4. But then again, he's in Sweden. So the sun is weaker most of the year up there. So he's been to his doctors, and they've basically tutted him and said, you're fine, you're healthy, don't worry about this. Well, first of all, Richard, you still have to fix that vitamin D. A low vitamin D has profound implications for health all over the place. Vitamin D is a hormone. It's really not a vitamin per se. That's a misnomer. And you need to get that level up to 35. You will not hurt yourself by doing that 5,000 units a day for even 10,000 units for a short period of time. But generally what I tell people is 5,000. And even the Institute of Medicine, which searched, by the way, exhaustively for an excuse not to say this, but couldn't find it, has said that 4,000 unit, we can't find anything that suggests that that's ever going to be a problem for anybody. That's, you know, given that they were looking, I feel very strongly that 5,000 is fine. And it will take 3 or 4 months to start to bring the levels up. You also need to get your testosterone looked at and get those levels checked. You could have early testicular testosterone failure, and that will cause those waking up. Basically, if your testosterone is low, you get insomnia and occasionally even hot flashes when you're male, particularly if it drops suddenly. I would have I would see an endocrinologist and have them check your beta HCG and your prolactin, and they will know what to check as far as the hormones are concerned, and you should ask them to do so. I'm also a little concerned about environmental pollution, particularly BPA, which is bisphenol A. It's in plastics, and it inhibits testosterone production and could be leading to your problems. Now, it's true that your semen volume declines with age, but it doesn't decline suddenly. So something has switched in your body, and you're right to continue to pursue getting this worked up. You also commented on a follow-up email that you had some bruises and a pigmentation change. And again, this could be Addison's disease. This could be a lot of things. This could be a problem with your platelets. You've got something going on here, and you need to push your doctors not to just poo-poo it, but actually get it investigated. Just a little comment on national health systems. You know, we all want to have some kind of better coordinated national system in this country, whether it's an insurance-based system or whether it's Medicare for all. But remember, be careful what you wish for, because the incentives in a national system where there's one budget is not to spend money. And so the incentives are not to work up the weird thing. Just as strong incentives, maybe even stronger, depending upon how the doctor's pay schedule is structured, than the incentives that exist in this country due to the impediments that insurance companies place in our way when we want to do medical workups. There's no completely right answer on how to fund healthcare. You always end up with perverse incentives in one direction or another. And the thing is, for us physicians, is we need to be able to tell the truth and advise our patients. And if you don't like the advice you're getting, you should have the right to get a second or maybe even a third opinion, because you never know. And it's important to be able to opt out of whatever system you're in and pursue alternative methods of investigation if you really are concerned and the existing system isn't doing it for you. The truth may, in fact, be out there. We're going to take a call from Marge in Santa Cruz. Hello, Marge. Welcome.
Well, thank you, Dr. Dawn. Thank you for your good work. I'm a 77-year-old, and I have osteopenia and osteoarthritis, and my doctor told me to just stop all calcium based on those recent studies that are concerning, and I didn't feel right about that, so I saw a very reputable nutritionist, and she thought I should be able to take raw calcium. Can I mention the brand or not?
Can mention the brand, but I don't. But I do have a question about, if you have osteopenia, why they told you to stop taking all calcium. Do you also have, like, very bad calcium deposits in your arteries?
No. I do not. Not that I know of. She just, this particular person isn't very in favor of supplements to start with, and she said, you just don't need that. There are studies showing that calcium can be deposited in the arteries and so on and so forth. That's why I sought further information.
Uh-huh.
And the nutritionist said, well, raw calcium, which is vitamin code brand, which is pricey, but she said, if you take that with vitamin K2, and you can take a smaller dose maybe than they recommend, you'd get some calcium, and she thought I should do that. So I'm asking your opinion on that. She said that K2 is very important for the absorption part.
Well, both vitamin D and K2, and for that matter, vitamin A, are all important in both the absorption of calcium and the deposition of calcium in the right place, which is to say in the bones and not in the arteries.
Okay, and those are both in this product.
Yes. Yeah, okay. So there's probably many, many products you could take. I have no idea what raw calcium means. I mean, it's a marketing term. It's not a physiological or a chemical term.
Uh-huh.
Calcium's a mineral. It's not a vegetable. Vegetables are raw. Meat is raw. Minerals are not raw. Minerals are minerals. They're rocks, very tiny rocks, but they don't have a cooked or uncooked state. So the term is kind of sounds like a marketing term.
Right. They say it's from organically grown fruit and vegetables,
mm-hmm.
plus the vitamin D3 and the other K2 and so on.
Right. But they're extracting it. And so by the time they extract it, it's a molecule.
And
right. It's a molecule. I mean, if you get dolomite, you know, that's got some lead in it. That is not a good calcium supplement to be taking. Some oyster beds that you get oyster shell calcium, some oyster beds are contaminated by industrial runoff. And so you'll get toxic metals along for the ride with your calcium. So you want to look at your sourcing, but you could probably do it a bit more cheaply. I think the key thing is to make sure you're getting adequate magnesium and make sure your vitamin D levels are good. My question is, you know, osteopenia at 77 is, it's kind of normal. So your Z score is probably like zero or one, which mm-hmm. is it, you want to look at your Z score, which is,
okay.
which is the score for women of your age.
Okay. I'll look at that.
Cause your T score, if you're osteopenic, that means your T score is less than -2.5, or they would be calling it osteoporosis. And the vast majority of 77 year old women have a T score that is in the minus range, because the zero range is if you're 35.
Okay.
So the question is two things. What's your risk of fracture? And that depends on your family history, your smoking history. And there's a thing called the FRAX score. If you Google that, you will find yourself with a questionnaire that you fill in based on your family history, your age, your smoking history, and it will give you a risk of fracture.
Okay, I'm sorry, what was the name of the acronym?
FRAX, capitals. Just put that in. It's an acronym, but I don't know what it stands for.
I got
for.
The RAX. I didn't get the
F as in Frank.
Frank, FRAX. Okay, got it.
All right. And so look that up. That will determine, you know, risk of fracture.
Okay.
Weight-bearing exercise is really important. Good. And did anybody in your family break a hip or have that dowager curve where they're...
Nope, none of that.
All right. So you've got good inherited bone structure, mm-hmm. and you've got thin bones, and you may never, at 77, I'd say you're in pretty good shape. So you can probably thread the needle here on the calcium. I would say 500 plus a good diet would be a reasonable amount with
okay.
at least 500, but if you can get it in, 1,000 of magnesium. You have to split that throughout the day, because you'll get the runs if you try to take 1,000 of magnesium all at once.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Make sure your vitamin D level is at least 40 and take supplements until it is.
Okay.
And get that vitamin K and K2 in there. I do agree that's extremely useful.
Okay.
And it is the MK7 subtype. Make sure there's some of that in there, because that's the one that pulls calcium out of the arteries.
I see. I'm sorry, what was that I should...
That's a type of vitamin K called MK7. It'll be listed on the back of that bottle if it's in there.
And you do want that, right?
You do.
And that is on this label. Okay.
Okay. So it sounds,
okay.
you know, it sounds like it's...
MK7, yes.
Right. Good.
Okay, well, that's very, very helpful. Thank you. I feel better about what I'm doing. And
good.
I have one other... May I ask you one other quick question?
Sure.
I've had a left hip replacement 3 years ago, and my right knee's starting to bother me, and I'm getting that checked into to see what's going on. But the same nutritionist also suggested I try taking hyaluron orally. Is that how you pronounce it? It's
hyaluronic acid.
Yes. Yeah. There's a new product, I think it's fairly new, to take orally, and I wondered if you know about that or have an opinion about that.
Well, I actually, hyaluronic acid is what's called a glycosaminoglycan. So it's a protein sugar.
Uh-huh.
And our cartilage is made up of protein sugar components, and the synovial fluid, which is the lubrication in our joints, is also made up of glycosaminoglycans. GAGs is what we used to call them in biochemistry, as in gag me. But anyway, the point is, some people seem to respond very well to taking that orally, and some people don't seem to respond at all.
Uh-huh.
There have been some studies looking at knee arthritis showing that if you take glucosamine sulfate over about 5 years, you can see a difference in the people who are taking it and the people who aren't taking it in the rate that they're burning through their knee cartilage.
Okay.
And this is people who already have knee arthritis. There's no studies in hips, but there's also no reason to assume that hips would be different. It's just harder to study a hip than a knee, and so it hasn't been done. I think that you may already be getting all of the glycosaminoglycans you need from your current thing. And there's a lot of very aggressive marketing that the nutritional companies are doing to acupuncturists and nutritionists. Very aggressive marketing.
Uh-huh.
And it's exactly the same playbook that the pharmaceutical companies use for doctors. You know, they come in, they buy you lunch, they give you a talk about how wonderful this product is, they give you some samples, maybe there's a break on the price. So there's a little bit of incentive to suggest the more expensive things.
Yes, indeed.
And so you have to kind of look at that. And in this case, I would not expect that you would have derived much additional benefit from the hyaluronic orally, because it's going to be broken down and absorbed and turned into the same thing that the glucosamine is going to be broken down and absorbed and turned into.
I wondered about that, because I've been taking glucosamine, chondroitin, and MSM for many, many years.
Yeah, so I think I do not think there's added value here for you.
Excellent. That's very, very helpful. I sure appreciate your time.
Thank you very much. Have a wonderful day.
You too. Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye. And I hope I will not get in trouble for inviting. I don't think so. I think this is a community radio station. Go to the website right now. Read up what's going on. There's a lot of moving and shaking going on. We need community input right now badly. There are proposals on the website about the future of KUSP. Things are very much in flux, and this is the moment to weigh in. So, being present, if you care about this station, at one of the meetings that are currently going on is extremely important. And you can get more information at KUSP.org. And I encourage you to do so. Our next email goes out to Anonymous in Boston. Several years ago, in the course of getting an MRI for presumed unrelated event, I was diagnosed as having an Arnold Chiari malformation. At the time, I was unsymptomatic, but in the intervening years, I began to experience an array of symptoms that are known to be caused by Chiari malformation, most notably fatigue, occasional vertigo, especially when I've been holding my neck at an extreme angle, looking down at a book or a laptop in my lap, central sleep apnea, blurred vision on waking, muscle spasms in back, shoulders, and arms. I've brought these up with my PCP and various specialists, but for the most part, they've been dismissive of the idea that any given symptom could be related to the Chiari. For 6 months or so, I've been having bad flare-ups of pain and numbness in my hands. Some of this is surely related to repetitive strain from working at a computer. I'm going to skip over the very good things that Anonymous has done, physical therapy, braces, etc., some anti-inflammatory treatment, and the orthopedist is recommending carpal tunnel release surgery. The EEG test clearly showed median nerve involvement. He means the nerve conduction study, not EEG, but it's an electrical study of the nerve. Basically, I want to know if there's a chance that the hand wrist pain and NCS results could be attributable to the Arnold Chiari malformation. I really don't want to have carpal tunnel surgery. Now, the Chiari malformation is where a part of the brain is actually at the level of the foramen magnum and can be pinched. And this is an important malformation. It is, however, something of a toxic meme, I think, in your case. In other words, you had an MRI which found something, which they often do, which was clinically silent. This happens all the time with little white spots in the brain that might be multiple sclerosis in a person who's maybe had that MRI because of a head trauma or migraines or something completely unrelated. And so now they're told, well, you may develop MS in the future, or in your case, you may have these symptoms, which, by the way, include death, and that's pretty scary and pretty toxic. If you've already done the splints and the ergonomic keyboard, the next step is probably a cortisone injection into the wrist. And the reason I'm suggesting this, Anonymous, is I think it'll be a convincer for you. I suspect that it will fix your symptoms. Now, it's obviously not going to fix the Arnold-Chiari malformation, so that will give you the proof of concept that you have carpal tunnel and you either need very, very distinct behavior change, maybe a job change, which may not be feasible for you, or to go forward with the surgery. But surgery should always be a last resort. And I do want to point out that steroid injections and, I got to put it out there, acupuncture can often be very successful in managing these problems more conservatively without having the release surgery. That being said, the release surgeries are now done endoscopically. They're very safe. Complication rate's quite low, and so don't be afraid if that's where you end up. Good luck to you, and I recommend also some sort of meditation or mindfulness therapy so that you can learn thought stopping, because unfortunately, this thing has gotten into your head. As I said, it's a toxic MRI meme, and the best way to deal with toxic memes is to learn how to stop the cascade of worry and fear that they generate. And that takes practice. So I recommend that you develop that practice. Good luck to you. Arnold Chiari is Arnold-Chiari. Let's go to Tom's email from Albuquerque. In the last 12 months, during a span of about 6 months, I've had two episodes of weird and debilitating inflammation, one in each calf. I've also developed a torn meniscus in my left knee. Now, Tom doesn't tell us how old he is. The onset of both problems occurred while I was out for regular exercise. I was running in a very typical, gentle, moderate way. All three painful episodes happened fairly suddenly, with a little warning out of the blue. Except for the last year or two, I've been developing Charlie horses, which is something my father used to have. I'm 59, and various aspects of my body seem to be developing signs of wear, but I'm wondering if there's anything else I can do. He mentions also that some of his family members had rheumatoid arthritis. So with respect to the torn meniscus, that one is a wear and tear phenomenon for sure. And they do occur spontaneously. Runners are more at risk, but it can happen to anyone. Skiing is actually one of the more common ways that people tear menisci. And just squatting and coming back out of that squat. It's a matter of the paperclip phenomenon. If you take a paperclip and bend it back and forth about a dozen times, it's almost sure to separate where you've been hinging it. And that sort of fatigue leads to micro perforations, and eventually even the menisci can let go and tear. Often they will heal. I recommend against meniscus surgery, because a year out from meniscus surgery, there's no difference between people who had surgery and people who didn't, the exception being people who are having collapse or locking of the knee, where the torn meniscus is actually acting as a physical wedge getting in the way of the normal hinging function of the knee. Developing the muscles, a great thing. You should get your red blood cell magnesium checked, because low magnesium is the most common cause of those cramps that you're experiencing. And if it's not in the upper one quarter of the reference range, then I would recommend supplemental magnesium. That is likely to take care of the cramping in your calves. Another thing is check your vitamin D level. When people start having these sorts of pains, I always think about whether vitamin D could be low, because it often is, and it's amazing how often these aches and pains improve. And last, you mentioned the rheumatoid arthritis. Very important to take a good probiotic mixture, particularly after any antibiotics. And you might ask your doctor to get an annual CCP test. This CCP test will help with early warning, and that can, I don't think your symptoms sound like rheumatoid arthritis, but of course, with a family history, you need to be monitored. And the first thing that we make antibodies to in RA is citrullinated proteins. So I hope that's been helpful. And let's go now to Gail in Pacific Grove. Hello, Gail. Welcome.
Thank you for all your wonderful information, as always.
Oh, thank you.
I'm about to have surgery on my foot, and I wanted to know, are there things I can do in advance to bolster my immune system so I heal better?
Tell me again what the surgery is.
I have fractured bones in my foot.
Okay.
And they're going to put pins and screws in there. It's going to be just delightful.
Well, you know, the foot is a complicated machine, and I know that you will need to have physical therapy and rehab no matter how good your surgeon is. It is difficult to, it's a Humpty Dumpty kind of situation. It's difficult to put it back together again. In terms of what you can help yourself with, first of all, a high protein diet for at least a couple of weeks, you know, clean protein. I'd go with a vegetable protein, like maybe pea protein or soy protein, whey protein, you know, one of those, or even a mixture.
What's the first one you said?
PEA.
PEA.
Yeah. So peas and soybeans are members of the legume family, and they have lots of protein in
like
them.
Pea soup, that kind of thing.
So plant protein powders maybe mixed into a smoothie. I'd really push the dose. You need to stay hydrated if you're pushing protein, but it's very good to do this prior to a surgery. Also taking some of that glucosamine chondroitin that I was talking about to another caller, because that helps.
Take it every day.
Okay, good. So we're already there. Check your vitamin D levels. Make sure that they're adequate. Adequate's 35 or above in my book. And take some extra calcium after the surgery, because you're going to want to build good strong bone around those screws, okay?
What would extra calcium, how would you do that?
Well, you could buy buy chewable calcium like Tums even. And
yogurt?
Well, yogurt has about 200 milligrams of calcium, and I'd probably take about 1,000. So it's a lot of yogurt, but every little bit helps. So sure, go with the yogurt. I like the probiotics in the yogurt anyway.
And did you say Tums?
Even Tums, yeah. Very cheap, very easy to find. I like calcium that comes in powdered form or chewable form rather than pill form, because I think it's better absorbed, and I believe the research backs me up on that.
Wonderful. And that's your prescription.
That's it. Simple, basic, but I think helpful.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Good luck.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
This email, I definitely wanted to spend a few moments talking about this program, so I'm asking the other callers to stay on the line. This is from Anna May in Monterey. My sibling is due to deliver in May and has chosen not to receive any vaccinations while she's pregnant. This includes the DTaP. She is requesting that all individuals coming in close contact with her newborn provide documentation they have received the DTaP within the last 2 years. She stated not only does her pediatrician recommend it, but it is also recommended by the AAP. The reason provided is that the pertussis vaccine efficacy depreciates quickly and only lasts 2 years. And she looked it up. She had her DTaP in 2012. Her husband had his in 2010. And the future mother, is dictating to her relatives that they need another vaccine. This is a newly recommended practice. I had another patient ask me about this in the office. So it's fresh off the presses, and it's going to be big, particularly in the wake of the current controversy in California about mandatory school vaccination. So now we have another vaccination mandate, this one being imposed on adults by pediatricians. The American Academy of Pediatrics has laid down the law and said this is the recommendation for protecting infants. Okay, so first of all, I believe that if you get a pertussis titer and can show that you have an adequate immune titer, that should satisfy your sister. And you'll probably have to get her pediatrician to rubber stamp it, because she's going to be afraid. Both you and your husband very likely still have adequate immune titers. What we know about boosters in adults is that the immunity begins to wane at about 2 years. Typically, you don't lose adequate levels of immunity. In other words, you've still got adequate numbers of antibodies at the four-year mark. That's when it starts to fail. That's not when it fails in everyone. There's a bell curve there that goes out to 14 years. So the data says 4 to 14 years before you're vulnerable again. Now, I will say that really kind of stinks. This is not a good vaccine. Our old DPT vaccine was much more antigenic. It was much more antigenic. That's a good thing and a bad thing. Your immunity lasted longer. Probably didn't start to wane until maybe 8 years, but we also had dead babies and brain damaged babies, because it caused enough of an immune storm in some people that they would get encephalitis, which could leave them brain damaged or dead. This is in infants receiving the vaccine. So as a result, an acellular vaccine was developed. But ironically, just at the time they were developing the acellular vaccine, the World Health Organization said, you know, we need to have a standardized case definition so that we can really test this scientifically. So we could test against the old DPT and show that the acellular pertussis was effective. So they redefined pertussis as having positives, or having a positive ELISA test and having 21 days of cough. Well, the problem is, that was a very, very strict definition, and a whole bunch of people who got a lighter, milder case of pertussis after vaccination weren't counted as having pertussis. So the vaccine came out with an exaggerated efficacy of in the 90 percentile. It's probably more like the low 70s, and that's to give you an immunity that starts to wane, we now know, at the two-year mark. So the AAP has said, we have to protect the babies. That's our mission. We're going to double down on this vaccination. Admittedly, it's not a very good vaccination, but we're going to make everybody take it more. The problem with that is that this vaccine contains adjuvants like aluminum that are very irritating to the immune system. And if we follow through with this, going to cause a lot of illness in adults who are perched on the edge of getting autoimmune disease, and this is going to kick them over the edge. And so we need to really rethink this. My advice, get a pertussis titer, take that to the pediatrician. Hopefully he or she will be intelligent enough to say, all right, that's good enough. Negotiate wearing a mask, like an N95 virus-proof mask. Bordetella is a bacteria. And a mask that keeps out viruses is going to keep out bacteria. Maybe you can wear the mask to see the baby if the sister is really going to be adamant about it. Or maybe you'll just end up Skyping. I don't know. It's her right to protect her child in the way she sees fit. But I believe that this is a wrong-headed recommendation that's going to cause a lot of angst and may have the unintended consequence of causing a bump in autoimmune disease in adult individuals who receive an early DPT booster. That has not been tested in clinical trials ever. And I just don't think it's prudent to be making this recommendation to adults. Let's go now to Elizabeth in SoCal. Hello, Elizabeth. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Dr. Dawn. Thank you so much for your wonderful advice. I've been suffering with osteoarthritis pain for the last 10 years, and taking supplements have worked, except for the last 2 months, 3 months, it's gotten excruciating painful. I've had to resort to taking Celebrex, which helps a little bit. And I'm wondering what your recommendation would be if I tried a gluten-free diet. Someone was saying take a lot of fresh ginger and turmeric, and what your thoughts are long-term effects of using Celebrex, which I'm worried about.
Well, the thing that really worried worries me about Celebrex in postmenopausal women is the heart attack piece. Uh-huh. And there was a relative of Celebrex, Bextra, that was actually pulled from the market because it, you know, you had these healthy women and there was an uptick in heart attack and stroke in that subgroup taking these COX-2 inhibitors. And the idea here is that aspirin and ibuprofen and the old anti-inflammatory drugs block both ends, both branches of an enzymatic pathway. And if you only block one branch, what you end up doing is making your platelets very, very sticky. And sticky platelets, if there's any place for sticky platelets to get caught, well, then they block that artery, and that's where the strokes and the heart attacks came from. So, and women, for some reason, probably because we detoxify things differently, we're more subject to this uptick. So I don't like Celebrex. It's a great drug, but I don't like it because it's, you know, it's this thing. And so I definitely try to avoid it in people who might have atherosclerosis or small arteries, which is basically women postmenopausal. The ginger is not a bad idea. The turmeric, if you're going to use it as fresh turmeric, you need to throw some pepper in there and a little fat all together. So like the classic Indian curry meals where they've got some pepper and they've got some turmeric and they've got some oil, that's going to be way better absorbed. I generally, if I'm going to treat arthritis with turmeric, I've got people on capsules and they're either making up the capsules on their own, the 00 capsules, 10% black pepper, 90% turmeric, and you take 4 or 5 of those capsules a day and you get enough curcumin, which is the active ingredient, to get some relief. And then I always put people on 4,000 milligrams of fish oil. I put people on turmeric. I like the glucosamine chondroitin, and those are the other things that I think can be very helpful for natural management of arthritis. Also, cat's claw, uña de gato, that's another really good anti-inflammatory that plays well with those. And so maybe if you go on that mix, and you can listen to the show on AskDrDawn.com. It'll be up on Friday. It goes up Friday night, so you can listen to get those instructions again.
And right. Gluten-free diet?
The gluten-free diet? Why the heck not try it? You know, in 3 weeks, if you go gluten-free in 3 weeks and your joints are feeling better,
right,
then you're benefiting. And that's nowadays not that hard to do because there's lots of good gluten-free foods.
Okay. Great. Thank you so much for your advice. And I will check out that last item you said. I'm not familiar with that.
All right. Well, you have a good day.
Thank you. You too. Thanks so much. You're wonderful.
Oh, and pool exercise too. Go jog at the deep end of the swimming pool wearing water wings.
Oh, okay.
Bye-bye. All right. Well, we've come to the end of another hour and I've really enjoyed it. I feel welcomed back by my community. Thank you so much and have a wonderful, healthy week. So long, stay healthy, and I'll talk to you later.